Welcome, I am John Cryer, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. This first episode of the new season of Undisclosed introduced the facts surrounding the murder of Domingo Martinez, a local entrepreneur and a very beloved pillar of his community who in November of 1990 was shot and killed during what the police called a bump-and-rob style robbery on the streets of Philadelphia. Now, despite several witnesses coming forward and even the conviction of four suspects, the mystery has only deepened over time. So with me today are the hosts of Undisclosed, Rabia Chaudhry, Susan Simpson, and Colin Miller. Hello, guys.
Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey.
It's so lovely to have you all back. Now, I know what Susan has been up to. She has been investigating the case of Gary Mitchum Reeves. But what about you, Rabia and Colin? Rabia, I assume you've been on a Polynesian island somewhere sipping non-alcoholic pina coladas and putting your feet up, right?
That's exactly what the mothers of new infants do. So, yeah, that's exactly what I've been doing. I've been just trying to desperately catch up on sleep with a baby butt as Susan has been unfolding her really fantastic story, and I just love that series so much. I could listen to Mitchum forever, by the way, Susan. And John, you guys did a great job on last week's addendum, but I've been investigating Sean's case and trying to get this series together because we've been kind of staggering our little mini series here.
And Colin?
Yeah, well, we're doing four of these cases out of Philadelphia, and I've been working on series 2 and 3, so after we finish with the Sean Thomas case, we'll have two more of these cases in 2017 that I've been working on.
Now, I've been getting a lot of requests from people online asking for updates about the status of Anand's case and the case of Joey Watkins. Do you guys have anything that you can share?
Yeah, I mean, I can update folks on Adnan's case. There's not a whole lot to update since our last update, which is that we are still waiting. We are still waiting for the appellate court to make a decision on the state's appeal. I mean, just to refresh people's memories, about a year ago, last June 2016, his conviction was overturned. The state appealed it. We had a hearing earlier this year. We are waiting for a ruling. There were a number of predictions that we would have gotten it by now. Unfortunately, it hasn't panned out. What was interesting to me is some news that came out just in the last week, which is the prosecutor who's been on the case since, I guess, since the PCR reopened, Thiru Vignaraja. He was the deputy attorney general of Maryland, and then he moved into a private practice firm, but continued to work on the case as a pro bono prosecutor. And now he just announced his run for Baltimore DA. He also gave some recent interviews and talking about like the considerations that prosecutors make when they offer plea deals. And there's a part of me that wonders if he's positioning himself in a way that would put him in power to, you know, if we win this appeal, that he would take it to trial. I feel like he's the kind of guy who really wants to take this to trial and would not offer a plea deal. Maybe it's in my head. I don't know. But that's pretty much everything that's going on. I don't think there's any. Have I missed anything, guys? I don't think so.
No. And for Joey's case, we're still waiting for that to go forward, both actually in Joey's habeas petition and in the trial tapes litigation that we had the hearing on back in May. So hopefully we'll have some updates there for you guys soon.
So I imagine you guys are inundated with cases of possible wrongful conviction. What brought these particular cases to your attention, and why are you pursuing them?
What happened was about a year, well, sometime in 2016, I can't remember exactly when, I was invited, and it was before the book came out. My book came out about Anand's case. It was around the same time. The publisher had me kind of on a book tour, and one of the places they booked me in was Philadelphia. And I ended up speaking at an event there on a panel with the executive director of the Pennsylvania. Well, actually, she was the legal director at the time, legal director of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. And during that presentation, her name's Marissa Bluestein. She talked about a case, and I was listening to the facts of this case, and it was this case, Sean Thomas. And it was just so egregious. I was kind of horrified, and I couldn't stop thinking about the case. And, because of the fact that this young man had a pretty solid alibi, and he had been in prison at that point, I think 22 or 23 years. And she talked about the challenges they were up against. So when Susan and Colin and I kind of got our heads together as we were considering like new cases, I suggested it. And, you know, then they said, okay, let's get some more information. So we reached out to them, the folks working on his case, and they briefed us as a team, and we decided to cover the story.
So, Rabia, you mentioned, amongst many other things, that there was a big gaping hole in the police records where there should be notes detailing the steps that the police were taking in the weeks following the murder. Did that mean that there were no daily activity sheets during the period of the investigation, or you just can't access them?
Probably the latter. Certainly there were activity sheets. Certainly there was investigation that was ongoing. We have very limited information about what the police were doing in the aftermath of the murder. But that's kind of typical, apparently, in Pennsylvania. And I didn't know this because, you know, I have never practiced there until I started working with these attorneys. And they explained that, you know, the homicide file, the actual police file, defendants are not entitled to that in discovery. And at the PCR level, you're not entitled to that, which is kind of crazy to me because that homicide file will include things like autopsy reports, medical examiner reports, I mean, things that a defendant would normally need and have access to, but they have to litigate it pretty strongly. So, you know, those things should exist. We know something was, things happened, but we don't have them.
Well, it sounds like Pennsylvania itself just has incredibly arcane rules. And my understanding is, and I've, you guys sent me some great materials before this, but that Pennsylvania ranks 8th in the list of the highest number of exonerations per state kept by the National Registry of Exonerations. And it has more than 250 death penalty verdicts which have been thrown out, the majority because of faulty representation. So it has the biggest reversal rate of any state in the country. So it seems to me like Pennsylvania in particular has really stacked the deck against people who may have been wrongfully convicted. Do you guys have any theories about why that has arisen?
Yeah, the discovery laws in Pennsylvania are the least favorable of any of the jurisdictions for the cases we've handled. There's a lot of police misconduct and corruption. There's a lot of aggressive prosecution of cases. So in addition to the wrongful convictions you mentioned, Philadelphia, there are 325 juvenile lifers serving juvenile life without parole. That's out of about 500 in the country. And so that gives you an idea of what's going on in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia specifically, is that defendants are not getting discovery, police are engaging in misconduct, and prosecutors are being overaggressive.
Do they give any rationalization for why they haven't changed these things? I mean, obviously, you know, you're dealing with several different issues, but it would seem like that's such an egregiously high level of, you know, exonerations and whatnot, that you have to look at the system that's creating all these wrongful convictions. Has there been any political will to do anything about these things?
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of these wrongful convictions took place in the 80s and 90s, and, you know, this is like kind of in the either pre-DNA evidence stage or early DNA evidence stage of criminal investigation, you know, like the kind of tools that folks had. But all the things that Colin cited, yeah, but I think there is definitely a growing awareness that this is a big issue. I think about 2 years ago, Philadelphia established a convictions review unit, CRU, and they've been, you know, part of this kind of movement towards, you know, exonerating folks, taking a second look at cases, and the Innocence Project folks, which, you know, we'll have them, I think, on the addendum next week. They've been working closely with the CRU to do that. What's also happening right now in Philly is that we're in the middle of an election for the new DA, and one of the front runners, in fact, the Democratic front runner, is a criminal defense attorney, Larry Krasner, who is vying for the role, and I think he's favored to win the position, which would kind of be a big upset in this dynamic. If you have somebody, this is a guy who dozens of times has sued the cops there. And so he's coming from completely the other side of the spectrum. For him to take that position, I think would be a big, big shift, big political shift.
Well, and it's great to hear that there is a conviction review unit in place as well. But I always wonder, my understanding is Texas has one that's been lauded quite a bit as well. But I always feel a little, while it's good that it removes the adversarial nature of it from the process because it's the state examining itself, I do worry that it's the state examining itself. You know, they haven't been great at that in the past. I mean, it's obviously, it's only been 2 years, so it would be hard hard to give a verdict on whether the review unit is doing particularly well or not. But have you heard of any cases that they've investigated?
This particular CRU? Oh, absolutely. Including the Sean Thomas case and others that...
Oh, they did. Okay.
Yeah. And others that we're going to be... Colin mentioned two of the cases he's going to be covering later this season. And Colin, do you want to tell the listeners what the name... I know we've gotten a number of questions about like what those cases are, which cases they are.
Yeah, yeah. The case that's coming, this would be our third case, is the Terrence Lewis case. And that is something that has been submitted to the conviction review unit. And here's the thing, John, is that up until earlier this year, it was essentially one attorney who was the CRU in Philadelphia and reviewing those cases. Earlier this year, they expanded it. Now there are four full-time lawyers and investigators, and they're full-time. The prior person, the one person, was part-time. And I think what the Pennsylvania Innocence Project is saying is, and what other attorneys are saying is, this is a complete overhaul. And there's reason to believe this is going to be an efficacious unit that actually has some teeth and looks into these convictions, whereas previously there were some big question marks about that.
But you're right. Not all of these units are empowered to do the work they need to do. It does vary very much with jurisdiction.
The fourth Philadelphia case that we'll be covering, which will be early next year, comes from an attorney who wants to submit the case to CRU, but he first wants us to kind of work on it and talk about the case and build some awareness around it before he actually submits to them. So I think a number of these cases have come from the Innocence Project right now. There are just dozens and dozens waiting to be reviewed by the CRU.
And our second case we're doing is another Pennsylvania Innocence Project case. It's the Willie Vesey case. And actually the prosecutor from Vesey's trial was that one part-time person who was the conviction review unit until earlier this year when they brought new people in. And it's again, these four people full-time as opposed to the one person part-time.
Support for Undisclosed comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, chances are that you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is easy. It's simple. It allows you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/undisclosed. Again, that's rocketmortgage.com/undisclosed. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030.
So I wanted to get back to the Domingo Martinez case. Because obviously, since you've had limited access to the records, you might not be able to answer a lot of my questions. But most of my questions came with the procedure of what the police did, which, as you've said, they've been not forthcoming. But I'm hoping that perhaps the trial revealed some of these things. Because like at the beginning, the police had three eyewitnesses that came forward, two men sitting in traffic just behind the victim's car and a third man behind them. And they were just feet away from the crime. And yet the police really paid attention to the fourth account, which was from a young woman who was fully a block away and didn't have a clear view of the shooting itself. Has it ever become clear why they depended on that account instead?
I mean, the only explanation at this point is that she was first in time, meaning she was the first witness they spoke to. What happened was, you know, when the victim, his car was sideswiped. And so it was a Tuesday morning and there was normal traffic on the road and there were cars behind him. The two cars directly behind him both had witnesses who actually gave statements to the police, but they didn't give them until a little bit later. The very first person to make a statement to the police was this young girl. She was 17 years old. He had been killed like kind of on this like this tiny little like, bridge that goes over. It's kind of curved, a little bit of a height. And she was visiting a relative at the end of that bridge. And Methel and I actually took a little, Methel, our executive producer, took a little road trip down there and found, you know, that the stoop that she was standing on and looked up at the bridge to see what the view would have been like. And so her story, what she saw was a gray car drive away from the scene. But she didn't really see much else. She didn't hear any shots. She heard some bangs, which made her look out. Now, the thing is, other than her being the first person to make a statement, and then that became like, you know, this flash information went out to all the police to look out for this car, There's no other explanation. And the interesting thing is the police should have known that behind the victim's car were a number of cars. And so that the car she saw could have been kind of anybody's car driving past.
Well, yeah, that's what I was thinking. Was it possible that it was Alan King's wife's car, who was, I think that was a silver Cadillac? You know, that would explain the gray car that she saw. Did that ever come up at trial?
No. It just wasn't a possibility that they considered. And that story also evolved over time. You know, I mean, we see this over and over again in wrongful convictions. When the facts don't fit the theory, they have to keep pushing. They have to keep evolving the theory to make it fit. So by the time we get to trial, it's going to be not one car. It'll be two cars. It'll be six suspects. There'll be two different colors. It changes some more.
Well, also, you know, police don't have access to all the information at one clear time at the very beginning. You know, as you pointed out, some people's accounts were a little bit delayed.
I mean delayed later in the day. I don't mean like weeks.
Oh, it wasn't weeks. Well, wasn't the young guy, Ron, he wasn't contacted until 2 weeks later, right? Smith, I think his name was?
Yeah, what happened was he left the scene and he saw an officer not far from the scene. He pulled over and said, "I just saw this happen and I'm letting you know this is my information." But then the police didn't contact him to get a fuller statement for a couple of weeks. But he did almost immediately tell a police officer. They just didn't follow up on it for a couple of weeks. The other gentlemen who were together... King and Howard, the other two gentlemen who were together, they also made a report the same day. They saw a police officer later in the day and this lady, and they said, "By the way, we saw this weird thing." They didn't know that they had witnessed a murder. They said, "We just saw this guy get pulled out of a car and, you know, we don't know what happened." And she connected the dots and said, "Oh, that was the Martinez incident." So it wasn't that far off in time that they had alternate theories.
Here's another question. Was any security footage recovered from the bank?
It's Mustafa's friend show up on there?
Exactly. That's what occurred to me. Also, if there was, you know, sometimes they have exterior cameras, which could have seen possibly the people lying in wait for the victim.
There wasn't any security camera footage introduced at trial, not internal footage or external. Apparently, there were cameras inside the bank, but at trial, the bank employee, Betty Ligon, she testified on cross-examination that they only turned on the cameras, like they were activated manually, and they only turned them on if there was trouble, which is kind of interesting because sometimes you don't know, you know, if there's going to be trouble. But in this case, apparently nobody thought there was trouble, so the cameras were not turned on.
I have to say, again, when I hear a lot of the time, criminals' plans are dumb. You know, they, you know, we've talked about this in the Adnan Syed case. The plan of the supposed crime was just nuts. Same with the Joey Watkins case. There was no, you know, these things happen and the prosecution's, you know, the plan that the criminals supposedly had at the time often don't make rational sense. And I understand that very often criminals are not people super clearly. But again, the Stallworth's plan seemed nuts to me, that they're going to send a guy into a bank who's just going to hang out for a while and hope that somebody gets a bunch of money in a bag. Meanwhile, by the way, there's a security guard in there whose job it is to just look out for that exact kind of thing. You know, I don't know how the guy intended to spend his time. You know, is, "Oh, I'll fill out this deposit slip. And oh, maybe I'll, you know, I mean, honestly, I don't know how this friend who was the lookout could have possibly gotten away with just sitting in a bank all this time doing nothing."
And they would have recovered the video. It was not a case like an Anand's case where it was like over 30 days before they knew they needed to check the footage. They knew within an hour this guy went to the bank, got a lot of money, and got killed. They pulled that footage.
You have to figure.
And if they didn't, they have some huge problems there, bigger than we already know of.
Yeah, I mean, all I can say to what you just said, John, is yes, you're correct. It's crazy. These things don't end up making sense because it's not what really happened.
Uh-huh. Did they ever introduce any kind of actual physical evidence in the trial?
Yeah, there was the physical evidence introduced. So the murder weapon was never recovered. The ballistics were kind of meaningless because of that. There's no physical evidence that ever tied any of these defendants, by the way, to the crime. Let me roll that back. The state said it was. And what they introduced was evidence that the victim's car and one of the cars that they tested, like, had paint, like transfer, like from the bump. So they argued that this transfer happened between a blue car, which is eventually what the theory became, a blue car and not even a gray car, but that Sean Thomas was in a blue car, and that this blue car had some gray paint on it that came from the victim's car, and that the same blue car also had a broken taillight when they found it. It's important for folks to understand Sean Thomas also wasn't arrested. These arrests weren't made for 3 years. So this ended up stretching out for quite a bit as they tried to piece together the case. So that evidence, that paint evidence at trial was the only evidence that was physical evidence that was, shown to the jury. Years later, apparently, there was other evidence that they did not disclose, and we're going to get to that.
And that car was somehow linked to Sean?
Yeah, he was seen driving a blue car. I mean, it's so vague. Like, that's literally as specific as it gets. Sean Thomas was seen driving a blue car in 1990 by local police. So they found a blue car that they thought was the blue car. And that's it. I mean, there's no other, you know, it's not even the gray car. It's a blue car. Because Sean Thomas was never linked to a gray car.
What kind of blue? There's a lot of kinds of blue out there in cars.
There's no it doesn't say specifically. And the thing is, Sean Thomas was never linked to any kind of any gray. Remember, he was six. By the way, he was 16 years old at the time this happened. So he wouldn't really have access to a whole lot of cars anyways, right? He didn't own his own car. There was no tie between him and the purported gray car that the one witness had seen that became the story. But he was seen somehow randomly driving some blue car that year by local cops. And the story became that it was a blue car and a gray car. Two cars. Chevy Novas.
So Sean was convicted on the basis of just the testimony of the Stallworth brothers and that tiny bit of physical evidence?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, I think even more so than that bit of evidence was also, I don't think was very conclusive necessarily, because they couldn't prove it was actual paint from the victim's car. It just was maybe gray paint. You know what I mean? They couldn't like match it to the victim's car, but it was really the Stallworth's confession. It was their confessions. You have brothers confessing and then pointing to Mustafa and Sean. And, you know, the brothers, they only got to the brothers through the cousin, Nathaniel. So you've got a whole family of people saying, yep, they were involved. That had the most weight at trial. And the defense was also really poor. And we'll talk about that next week, actually.
Yeah, another huge flaw in the crime. Well, I mean, the whole crime is a flaw. But but another sort of thing that really struck me was that it became violent so quickly in a situation that required no violence. I mean, there's nothing from a witness that would make anybody understand why a shooting was necessary at all. Domingo Martinez was 78 years old. He's an elderly man. It begs sort of a completely new theory of the crime. And in that respect, I was wondering, is considering he was, you know, a very well-known guy in the community. He was in politics. Does anybody know if he made any enemies at that time? I mean, there are. And obviously, it's just a huge coincidence that he happened to be carrying a large amount of money at that time. Or was it? You know, was there somebody who perhaps knew that that might be necessary? Were any of those possibilities looked into by the police?
Yeah, I mean, what we do know about the early investigation in the first couple of weeks is the police looked first at family members and then quickly dismissed them. So other than beyond that, there's no evidence to suggest that they were looking at any other kind of, like, you know, political or community enemies or anything like that. And, you know, I mean, he wasn't really highly politically active. He really just kind of did more like community building stuff. So I don't think that was ever a serious consideration. But it's a good point. It's a good point that, you know, it didn't have to be violent to get his money. He could have been robbed without the violence. But it does happen in lots of, I mean, like people get mugged and violence happens. So it's not also completely unusual, even if it's random.
Did the prosecution provide any kind of theory as to why Mustafa supposedly suddenly decided it was showtime and that required gunplay? It seems like their story is so bare bones at this point that there's no reason for it to escalate that way.
Well, you know, I always think about in Adnan's case, you know, like all that extra dialogue that Jay gave us, you know. I kill that bitch with my bare hands type of extra dialogue. And apparently in this case, one of the witnesses does testify or maybe it was during in a statement. But anyhow, one of the witnesses just say that everybody else was shocked. Why did you shoot him? And Mustafa said, well, I don't like to leave witnesses behind.
Oh, okay. Well, that...
Except for all the cars that are following
exactly,
you.
Exactly. There's, you know, 8 cars lined up behind you. It's in a public place. That's where you decided to do your bump. It's a very strange crime. You know, again, it seems like the prosecution's theory is that this was just happenstance, that they saw this guy, he had a lot of money, and they said, okay, now, you know, then that would account for a fair amount of sloppiness. But it and perhaps that's what swayed the jury. They just thought, well, this, you know, whole thing was just so improvised that it just went horribly wrong.
I mean, I think there's always been a lot of value given to people who confess, right? I mean, like even with the Nance case and many other cases, it's always like, well, why would anybody confess unless they were part of it? Like, why would they even do that? The eyewitnesses, if you take their statements together, we know there were at least three people involved in the crime. And so, you know, if the Stallworth brothers said, well, it was us two, well, they're still missing at least one more person. So for two brothers to confess, I think that just carried a tremendous amount of weight with the jury. And it's taken many, many years now to understand that, just because, and you know, right now there's like that series on Netflix called The Confession Tapes, which shows that people will confess sometimes when they have nothing to do with anything. And so you have to be also very wary of those confessions.
Well, there's no hint of exactly what the circumstances were for the Stallworth brothers' confession. It sounds like, from the limited facts we got from the first episode, it sounded like an informant suggested there was a rumor flying around that they were involved. And then 3 years later, the cops picked them up and they just spilled their guts. Which sounds a little odd. It's, you know, for 3 years you've gotten away for this thing, and then suddenly you just decide, you know, I'm going to come clean, even though there's no particular reason to at this moment. Was there any understanding of the circumstances of their confession?
Oh yeah, there. I mean, it took years for investigators and defense counsel to understand exactly what happened and why it happened. There were some, you know, specific circumstances that led to those confessions, but yeah, the official story is we picked them up and they just confessed. And that's not exactly what happened, but I'm going to be piecing all that together for listeners next week.
Yeah, Rabia, did they ever try to investigate if, like, I mean, a 16-year-old kid that has $5,000 or whatever, that'd be pretty conspicuous. Did they ever try and investigate if he ever had that kind of money?
That would not. Why would they do
rhetorical
that?
Question.
Yeah.
Why would they do that? No, of course. No, they didn't. They didn't. Yeah, that would be a lot of
but
cash.
But in the episode... you mentioned at one point that one of the Stallworths says that he heard on the news it was $25,000. Is that what he said in his interrogation?
Well, originally, William Stallworths, who was the cousin, said that the take was supposed to be was $15,000, and it was divvied up in a couple different, like, at a couple different times. And then later it was discovered that the news said it was 25, and I don't know if the suggestion was that somebody in the group like took more of the money and didn't tell the other members. But, you know, by the time they got the confessions they needed, they had that fact right. And they, you know, they also mentioned that, you know, it was mostly in 20s. And, you know, I talked about the denominations that that Martinez had picked up. And yeah, there was like $11,000 of $20 bills. So if somebody said that, I guess that would make sense. But they already knew that. They knew the exact denomination. And when I say they, I mean the police. They knew the denominations anyway. So there's always the question of how much of what is being told by these witnesses is coming from information the police have at the time.
And did the Stallworth brothers have a record at that point? At one point in the episode, it was hinted that the prosecutor was going to make a case that they had tried this before.
Well, I mean, look, they didn't have – they weren't completely, you know, clean – cut. I mean, they did have a history of, yeah, I mean, like, they did have some criminal history there. I mean, John, in fact, had an outstanding warrant. Nathaniel, the cousin, he had all kinds of issues, and he had rape allegations. And now, interestingly, William said that he was part of a kind of a local Abbotsford Homes gang that, you know, that they would kind of do petty robberies, but nothing like this, nothing violent. So they did have a little bit of a history, yeah.
And did Sean Thomas have any history?
Sean Thomas also did. Sean Thomas, you know, had, and, you know, we ended the episode with the fact that he was in court. He was in court because he had gotten picked up for trying to steal a bike the night before. And so, you know, he's 16 years old, but yeah, he had done like some stupid stuff. And so he did have some history there.
reinventing men's basics. That's the mission of Mack Weldon. Michael Isaacman and Brian Berger founded Mack Weldon for a simple reason. When they would buy socks, shirts, undershirts, and underwear, it was impossible to find men's basics with consistent fit and consistent quality. So they went about in creating a company with men's basics made out of fabrics that give customers both. Mack Weldon products use three main fabrics. One is 18-hour jersey, a blend of cotton, beechwood modal, and lycra that sits for 18 hours before it's cut to get consistent fit and unparalleled softness. A second is silver. Favored by Olympians and NASA, silver kills odors by neutralizing bacteria. And finally, there's AirKnit. Designed from materials used in cooling vents, AirKnit is designed for breathability no matter what kind of heat you're facing. I'm proud to be a Mack Weldon customer, and their clothes look great and feel great, whether I'm wearing them to work or work out. And their website is so easy to navigate. There's a reason that the Huffington Post calls Mack Weldon the Apple of underwear. And here's the thing. Because Mack Weldon wants you to be comfortable, if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it, and they'll still refund your money, no questions asked. So go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using the promo code undisclosed.
Just to go, like, one thing, the whole episode I kept going back to was the idea, like, where is the bank at all this? Not just the bank video, but the idea that a bank would let someone just loiter in the bank waiting for someone to get a lot of money and then follow them out and have them killed. Like, the bank should care a lot that that's what the state's claiming. I mean, that, I think possibly civil liability could attach to that, maybe. At the very least, it'd be a huge PR issue. Customers aren't going to be lining up with this bank anymore if they know that's how they operate. And yet, no one ever seems to have asked them, like, is it possible y'all were so negligent you helped an obvious murder happen?
Well, and obviously the security guard had a conversation with Mr. Martinez as he left. So it isn't a case of the security guard asleep in the corner.
He walked him out.
He walked him out. So, again, it seems too lucky to me that these guys just happened to, you know, say, let's pull off a follow and bump robbery, and it just happened to hit the jackpot with this guy. It strains belief.
Yeah, I just don't get why the attorneys wouldn't call the bank, because the bank's going to have a big reason to object to that whole version of the story.
I think the attorneys missed a lot of opportunities in the defense. You know, as I mentioned before, the defense was pretty weak. They put on exactly one witness on the stand, and they didn't explore what you're talking about at all, Susan. Also, you know, the bank itself, I'm guessing folks there would not know exactly what that narrative is going to be, because we're talking about years later that this thing went to trial. I'm guessing nobody at the bank like was attending the trial and following. And these things are not even reported in the newspaper that carefully, that detail, that this is exactly what happened. And then when it comes to civil liability issues, well, yeah, I think that could have been a possibility if somebody existed who could have raised that possibility, right? Like if somebody in his family, and I'm going to talk about the family later, kind of like what happened to them after this attack and their business and everything, because he was pretty prominent in the community and it did have an impact on the family and the business. But suffice it to say that none of them were positioned to bring that kind of a suit.
So the police talked to this informant who told them about the rumors around Abbotsford homes. Did that informant come into play at all later in the trial? Was that ever used as evidence in any way?
The informant did not testify at trial. And the way that it was discovered that the informant is even the one who kind of got this started was because many years later, one of Sean's attorneys contacted her when her name came up in the file and said, you know, what happened here? Why were you kind of involved in this? And she's the one who told him, oh, I just heard this rumor and I told the police, but she had no actual information. I just heard a rumor.
So it didn't play a part in the trial?
No, it didn't.
It makes sense for me to, you know, for cops to obviously use informants and to take in information from the community. I don't see there anything necessarily wrong with that. And that's going to be wrong a lot. That's the nature of rumors. But I'm sure every now and then it yields something helpful. Do you feel like it's set the whole investigation off? I mean, because obviously for the police, consider it a success because the Stallworth brothers came in and confessed.
Yeah, I mean, definitely that. I mean, those rumors, that is kind of what, you know, that coupled with the eyewitness statement of the gray car, those two things are what drove the investigation. That was the theory of the case now. And then the cops just had to make it all fit together. They really didn't. I mean, there's no evidence. Again, we don't have the complete homicide files, but there's no evidence that they followed any other leads. Once they got a hold of that informant information, that was it.
And the only evidence we have against the Stallworth brothers is their confession.
That's right. There's no evidence of the money. You know, they weren't able to follow the money. There's no evidence of the weapon. It's their own confessions, yeah.
Colin, did you have any questions?
Yeah, I'm going to guess that most of the ones I have will be brought up in future episodes, but I guess we'll see. So, Robbie, what can you say about the legal representation that Sean had at trial and the defense that they put on?
I mean, you know, you know, we ended the episode with the revelation that Sean had an alibi, a really strong alibi, which was the state of Pennsylvania itself. And that evidence, you know, could have been put on in a much better manner. Defense counsel did attempt to prove it, but they didn't do a great job in providing the evidence. And in fact, the jury was interested in getting more evidence about that because it was raised at trial. But the defense counsel just didn't do a good job of providing the evidence the jury requested. And they didn't, like I said, they presented exactly one witness. They didn't do any, and it didn't seem like they did any independent investigation like Susan suggested. So it was lacking. It wasn't great.
What about Mustafa's friend? Did they try and find him ever?
Mustafa's friend was always the friend. Nobody knows who Mustafa's friend was.
They never tried to find that? Or,
you know, it was suggested that he was a number of different people, and each time one of the stalwarts brought up a name, it kind of, that person, like, it didn't work for different reasons, and I'm going to explain that next week. But no, nobody tried to find the friend. The friend just poof, was just disappeared. And so the friend would have been the fifth perp, and then the sixth person, there were supposed to be six people. There also was no sixth person charged.
And I'm hoping that down the line, at some point, you follow the path of how the number of co-conspirators ran from three to six.
Yeah.
I will be fascinated by that process. I hope we get into it.
Yep. Next week.
Actually, you know what? It did occur to me why the police might not have checked the security footage at the bank. Only because after the robbery and murder, they didn't have the knowledge that the conspirators had followed him at the bank. They were just coming out of, there's a guy who got shot dead in his car, and some people took something out of it. I imagine once the family told them that he had just picked up $25,000, yeah, then I would have checked.
I mean, this would be the luckiest carjacking of all time. Like, what are the odds that a carjacking has ever happened by pure coincidence? Like, moments after someone gets $25,000 out of
the bank. Well, I mean, there's no pure coincidence here. That's for sure. And I think the state was able to cover those tracks by saying, well, these guys, they had a lookout. They had somebody go in into the bank. They had Mustafa's friend looking at the bank. This old man was a local businessman. Maybe he knew him. But also, they were, like, sitting in a car waiting around the corner from the bank for, you know, their victim, some victim to emerge and for them to follow. Like, they had not decided on a victim. It's not like they had staked this person out previously, but they were looking for somebody who's going to leave the bank and have been given a bundle, I guess. Or maybe they just took a chance and they got lucky that it was 25K. Regardless, they were looking for somebody who went to the bank and definitely made the withdrawal. Because, you know, somebody could have gone to the bank. The same guy could have gone to the bank and just made a deposit and left.
But in any scenario, the bank's an important part of the crime scene. Like, it's involved. Like, people at the bank are involved. So there's no universe in which there could be an excuse for them not to have investigated the bank.
Well, except though they didn't get that theory until later.
But even from the start, though, they had to have known there's a really strong chance that this is connected once they learn about the money. I mean, like, I would hope the cops wouldn't go like, wow, that carjacker sure got lucky. The bank clearly is not involved, so let's not go check it out at all.
I thought it was really interesting that the prosecutor, in his opening statement, was trying to cover the fact that the crime didn't really make sense by providing their alternate plan, which was that if somebody hadn't taken a car, they would have just followed him down the street and clubbed him from behind. I thought that was interesting. He's like, he knows that people are going to have a hard time believing the theory of the crime to begin with. So he puts in, they had a plan in case it went another way. I thought, okay, well, he's trying to cover his bases, clearly.
I mean, it's an argument that I feel like I've become familiar with. I've heard it in other cases, including in Nods, which is like, you know, when it doesn't fit, the state says, well, but this is the best, you know, this is, you work with the evidence and the witnesses and everything you have. And this is, and criminals aren't that smart. And that's just, yeah. I mean, nobody can expect these people to be masterminds. I mean, I personally, I thought one of the strangest things to me about the idea that the crime would unfold like this, and maybe it's just me because I'm not a morning person, is that all these young guys would get together like at 8 a.m., 9 a.m. on a Tuesday morning and be like, what are we going to
do? If I do a murder, I'm waiting till like 2 o'clock.
Exactly.
Totally. Yes. I would wait till like 2 a.m. at an ATM machine. I mean, these are some early, you know, these are some, you know, early bird gets the worm type of folks. And so I thought that was odd. But these were all young men. They were all young at the time that this happened.
Were they adults though? Or was, I know Sean was a minor. Were the other ones?
The other ones, yeah, the other ones were adults. They were eligible to get the death penalty.
Which would give them a huge incentive to incriminate somebody. Interestingly, not themselves. You know, I participated in the robbery, but it was that other guy, Mustafa, who just decided it had to be a murder for no reason. Interesting. I had a couple of questions from social media. There weren't a lot. Most of them were just saying, yay, we're so glad you're back, which is awesome. Obviously, great to hear. In fact, this one came from at the Jury Room blog, which says, yes, 3 exclamation points. Thank you. Who are the three cases besides Sean? Which you've actually mentioned. But then he also goes on to mention, I have 5 friends who are wrongfully convicted of murder in Philly in the 80s, too, which is, you know, obviously a horrifying statistic. I hope, you know, I honestly hope he's finding some new friends. I mean, this is horrifying.
This listener has actually been in touch with me. I don't know if it's like they kind of do it independently, but they do criminal investigations. And I think because of the fact that they had so many friends who were experienced this, and one of their friends actually was recently released, exonerated. Well, not exonerated, but given a plea deal. So, you know, this person actually is like, you know, one of the cases I've been working on, actually Sean Thomas's name comes up in it. So I was like, all right, email me, let's chat. So you never know some of the connections that might arise. And I hope, actually, and I didn't say this in the podcast, but I hope if there's listeners out there who have any information on any of the cases that we're gonna be doing, any of these Philly series, and this series is not just connected because of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, but also because of other names that will appear in the files repeatedly. Anything about the defendants, the cops, the victims. I've tried in this case to find distant relatives of the victim, other people in the community who knew him, and just, you know, have hit a wall. But we'd love to hear from them. So please do reach out to us.
Yeah. And this goes for all cases, but if there's any case we've done that you know anything even like tangential about, we'd love to hear from you. Don't be like, oh, I only know a small thing. We don't care if you're like, you just had a friend's cousin that was a witness that day. We want to hear from you.
Yeah. Or a story your grandmother heard.
Yeah, the name of the person that was referenced by this person on Twitter, it's the James or Jimmy Dennis case. And it's interesting because, as Ravia noted, this was a case where there were Brady violations all over the place in terms of the prosecution not disclosing evidence. And it seems quite clear from evidence, including an alibi, he's innocent. And yet, rather than exonerating him, they had him enter a no contest plea, which is essentially a guilty plea. I'm not going to contest the charges against me. And just a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, there was an article, I think, of ProPublica about Baltimore, and basically the same type of thing with these cases. Even when there's strong evidence of misconduct and strong evidence of innocence, it's prosecutors in both Baltimore and Philadelphia forcing these defendants to take Alford pleas or no contest pleas or guilty pleas, as opposed to just saying this conviction is invalid and we're going to throw it out. So that's an interesting phenomenon that many defendants are dealing with.
Yeah, and they maintain their innocence, but they're being forced to take these deals. It's really unfair.
Yeah, we got into that in talking about the possible scenarios for Adnan, and because considering his trial keeps going on, or not his trial, rather his lack of trial at this point, the appeals process just keeps going on in what I consider an inhumane manner. There is a point at which it becomes immoral that the state keeps pursuing these things if the case has fallen apart completely. I have in the past just chalked it up to institutional inertia and or, you know, I think, as I said, I think the adversarial nature of the process makes people just unwilling to admit, you know, that they may have gotten it wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to culture. I mean, I don't know exactly how to account for this, but I think it's going to be interesting to watch what happens in Philadelphia if Krasner is elected DA if he wins in November. And if he does, I feel like, you know, that's the kind of signal, like, we, you know, right now, like I said, you know, Vignaraja is going to be running for DA. And if you look at the candidates across the spectrum running for this position in Baltimore, none of them are like Krasner, right? None of them are coming from the same kind of background as Krasner. And it would be interesting to run candidates like that all across the country, especially in cities and jurisdictions where there's been like a long history of misconduct and wrongful convictions, to finally get people who maybe can shift the culture of that institution completely.
We got one last social media question, actually from Innocence Project of Pennsylvania, and it's totally a tee-up question for you guys. It says, how can a man with the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania as his alibi get convicted? Which is, that's like a kid, you know, asking Babe Ruth as he steps up to the plate, hey, how far can you hit a home run, Babe? It's like, let me show you, kid. I have a feeling we're going to get into that.
Yeah. But I think it comes down to the fact that a lot of these jurisdictions, a lot of the law enforcement officers, investigators, treat confessions as somehow ironclad facts. They have it in their head that no one would ever confess to a crime or even accuse someone else of a crime, like a friend of theirs of a crime, unless it was true and they were involved. I mean, of course, they might get some details wrong or try and deny their own culpability, but they have this belief that that confession is gold and that anything that contradicts that must be wrong.
Yeah, and we'll see. The series after this will be the Willie Vesey case, which also is a case with a strong alibi and a confession. And it's very similar in terms of the arguments made by the prosecution at trial. And yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people think if you have a solid alibi, you're not going to be convicted. And I think both this case and the Willie Vesey case are evidence that, at least in Philadelphia, that's not a guarantee.
Well, I was going to answer the question that Innocence Project posed. They know the answer. But basically, the bottom line here is, it's one thing to have an alibi. It's another thing to have an alibi that cooperates. So we'll just leave it at that for now.
Well, thank you, guys. And I'm very much looking forward to next week. Well, that is another addendum on the books. We will be dropping a new episode next Thursday and every Thursday until we get this thing done. Remember, all the case documents and photos are posted at undisclosed-podcast.com. You can also find a very handy list of all the charities that I mentioned from last season if you'd like to make a donation. Your donation would be very appreciated still. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod. I also wanted to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon, for his research and in joining me in my Undisclosed fandom. I told you you'd get sucked in, dude. I also want to thank Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for audio production. Patrick Cortez composed the addenda theme, and Meethal Telhan as our project manager. Thanks so much, you guys, and I'm looking forward to next week.
Rabia, are the spiders gone?
The spiders are not gone. Those things. You know what? I put that... I didn't know there were spiders, Susan. I touched it. I have a plant that is covered in white stuff that is terrifying. I thought it was like a fungus. Susan's like, you are growing spiders. So... I immediately bought like this nuclear grade plant spray on Amazon, and as soon as it comes, I'm just going to soak this poor plant. It's a huge plant too. It's huge. So I probably own like a million spiders at this point. I don't know.
So you're just living with the spiders and your children.
Yep.
Right now.
I bet you my infant right now he's probably sucking on a leaf as we speak upstairs somewhere.
Oh, great.
Protein.